Welcome to Get Excited and Make Things with Science. I hope you all are excited, as it seems like you are. Was that a cat meow? Jesus. So, yes, welcome to Get Excited and Make Things with Science. We have some lovely slides up here. This is a launch of some teddy bears into space, and so I thought it represented getting excited and making things with science. So this isn't Photoshop. This is actually a real picture. And if you want to get really excited, you can hashtag us at SXGetExcited. But we'll just start with some brief intros to kick things off. Jeremy, how did you get here?
Okay, can everybody hear me?
This lapel mic thing, or should I use this one?
No. Okay, I'll use this one. That makes it easier. So I got here because of South by Southwest, actually, which was 2 years ago. 2 years ago when I was here, there was an awesome science panel. I was moderated by Tantek, who's sitting there, and Ariel was on the panel and a bunch of other citizen scientists, and it was really, really inspiring. It was one of the best panels I've seen at South by Southwest. But one of the points that was coming across was there was all these APIs out there that people weren't using. Like, people were having hack days and doing mashups, and they were doing stuff with Google Maps or something. But we've mapped the moon. We've mapped Mars. Nobody's doing hacks and mashups with that kind of data. So I distinctly remember sitting in the audience of the panel and turning to my friend saying, we should have a science hack day. And then rather than it just remaining an idea, I did it. So we had the world's first science hack day in London later that summer. And it was incredible. We managed to get a venue, which was at the Guardian offices in London, got a bunch of developers into the room and some scientists as well. And it was a lot of fun. So I'd been to hack days before, which is, developers getting together for 48 hours, essentially hacking straight through for 24 hours and making something cool, usually mashups and stuff. So it was basically a hack day like that, but with the emphasis on science. In other words, that the APIs and the data that you'd be mashing with would be science data. And that was awesome. That showed that it could work, and that's what got me here.
Matt?
So my name's Matt. I'm a particle physicist by training, and I was doing research at Stanford University on the Babar experiment. I'll mention a little bit more of that later. And the experiment was based at SLAC, was a natural lab on Stanford campus, and I've been trying to work with some people in communications there to do some outreach projects. And through that, I met Dave Harris, who is a friend of Ariel's. And we tried getting some stuff, but there was just limited resources. He's like, well, look, my friend Ariel's putting together this science hack day. And some of these outreach ideas, some of these ideas of taking your particle physics data and making it more accessible, you might be able to get other people involved in working on the project. And then I participated in that first science hack day down in Palo Alto. It was a great success. I've done another one in San Francisco since then. I'll talk more about those in detail. But that was the path that led me to hack day in general and Ariel in here.
So I'm Ariel, and I am on a really awesome panel because Jeremy is an awesome web developer. Matt's a great particle physicist. I myself, however, am neither a programmer or a scientist. I have no background in science, and my degree is actually originally in print graphic design. That didn't really end up going anywhere. A few years ago, I randomly got a job at NASA, and it was amazing, and I never expected to work there, and it completely changed my life. And so since working at NASA, I am on now this mission to really change how we view space exploration. So I always like showing this slide because space exploration often changes how we view ourselves and our place in the universe, but I really think we should change how we start viewing space exploration and science, and it being something that you don't have to have a formal science background to do, and to participate in a science hack day, you don't need to be a developer or a scientist. Sometimes it helps, but I have proven that you don't have to be one. So I went on to create Science Hack Day San Francisco after Jeremy created his in London. So without further ado, Jeremy, do you want to discuss some of your favorite science hacks?
And oh, yes.
Why they're awesome?
I'm just going to geek out for a while. I'm talking about things I think are awesome, specifically science hacks. So I remember being at the hack day, not a science hack day. This is one of the official sort of Yahoo BBC hack days in London. at Alexandra Palace. And it was an amazing experience. It was just a fantastic time. And there's all sorts of hacks and mashups and stuff being done, incredibly inspiring stuff. But one of the ones that I really liked was just really simple, you know, really simple example of a mashup. And it was this, which is a Twitter account. And it's a Twitter account that it's a bot, and it mashes up just two simple bits of data. One is, when is the ISS flying over, or when there'd be iridium flares from satellites? And the other is, what's the weather forecast for London right now? Right, because it can get pretty cloudy in London. So it's a very simple little Twitter bot that just says, hey, the ISS will be flying over, and it's going to be clear outside. Simple, right? I know everybody makes lots of Twitter bots these days. It's kind of the hello world of mashing up. But this was a few years ago. This was, you know, a pretty cool idea. So I really love the simplicity of that, of just taking these two sources of data, putting them together, making something really cool and really useful, right? That you go outside and see the ISS fly over, which is awesome. Another example of one of these Twitter bots is low-flying rocks. This is really nice. And that's just, again, taking a feed of information that we have, which is when near-Earth objects are passing by the Earth, and just tweeting when it happens. And interjecting, maybe, you know, if it was a close one, it says, phew, that was close. But I love these little Twitter bots like that. So at the Science Hackathon in Palo Alto, Nathan Burgey, who's a rocket scientist, amateur rocket scientist in Portland, he was at the hack day, and he took this Twitter bot, and he decided he wanted to make a sort of physical representation of it. So he was going to make the near-Earth object lamp. So instead of tweeting when an asteroid was about to pass close to the Earth, you'd get a glow. You'd get this ambient signifier. And it was truly a hack. So he's got, like, cups that happen to be lying around the room, an Arduino that's, you know, connecting it up to a laptop, LEDs to glow. So, you know, you'd just have this thing sitting there, and it glows when there's rocks flying past. And he got a video of it here doing it. It was awesome. It was really cool. And that all happened in the course of the Science Hack Day Palo Alto. Brilliant little idea. There we go. Glow away. And he took this one stage further. After the hack day, he thought, okay, here's another idea. What if we went back to that Twitter bot of when the ISS is flying over? Now, instead of getting a tweet when the ISS flies over, you're going to have a lamp that lights up. And he put this idea out there, and he put it on Kickstarter, and it got funded. So you can now order your ISS lamp, right? That it will glow when the ISS is flying over. So you can nip outside, look up in the sky, and see the International Space Station flying over. I love that hack. I think it's great. I mean, I particularly like it when there's some sort of physical dimension to the hacks, and especially when it's taking something from the network and making it physical. I think that's really nice. Like at Science Hack Day in London, there was some people making sort of paper mache globe of the Earth that had LEDs inside it, again connected with an Arduino. But the data stream that they were connecting it to was the Aurora Borealis, right, when they were lighting up. So as the auroras were lighting up in real life, you got this beautiful sort of ambient lamp lighting up. It was really nice. So one of the things about the hack days is there's generally no shortage of developers showing up at hack days, which is great. And I really like when hardware hackers show up too. But it can be tough to get designers showing up at science hack days, or at hack days in general, I would say. It can be tricky to convince the designers to come. So I was really trying to do that in the run-up to the Science Hack Day in London. I was really trying to convince designers to come along. And there were a few designers there, but it would have been nice to have some more. So at the Science Hack Day in Palo Alto, I wanted to show how design can really, you know, help in the story of science and helping telling the story of science and data visualization. So I put together this little hack over the course of the Science Hack Day in Palo Alto, and it's just a simple little web page called Spacelift. And what it does is it just compares the cost of getting a cargo into geosynchronous orbit using various rockets. Right now, the cargo I chose happen to be various fictional spacecraft, like, you know, the Millennium Falcon or an X-Wing or Battlestar Galactica, and then compares how many of those rockets it would take and how much it would cost to lift this cargo into orbit, but always ending with how much it would cost with a space elevator. It's always cheaper with a space elevator. So I'm, you know, I'm trying to tell a fairly obvious story here, which is that we need to build a space elevator, and here's why. And I'm making the financial case, but I'm trying to use visualization to do it. I mean, you can sort of see it when it's just an X-wing that you're trying to lift into geosynchronous orbit, but if it's a Rebel blockade runner, you can clearly see the astronomical, literally, costs it takes, or one space elevator, right? Or you can then click through any of these and you can see that represented as the cost can be represented as a pile of pennies, and you can see the relationship of that pile of pennies to a space elevator, whether it would be a pile of pennies greater than a space elevator. So those are all things that happen at Hack Days, but there's a whole bunch of wonderful websites that are kind of in the spirit of Science Hack Day, the spirit of science hacking, and one of those. This is one of my favorite sites on the web, is spacelog.org. Has anyone seen spacelog.org? Okay, one of the creators is sitting right back there, Norm. Hello, Norm. It's wonderful, and it does exactly what I was saying about using design, using visualization to help tell a story. So what Spacelog is the transcripts of various NASA missions, Gemini, Mercury, Apollo missions. And those transcripts have been online for a long time. You can go to the NASA site and you get them, but they're just plainly presented. It's just text. They're not designed. And with Spacelog, these guys went off to a fort for a week and hacked on making a beautiful website to present this data, this information, and also to create like a linkable resource for every utterance that happened during an Apollo mission or a Gemini mission or a Mercury mission. And it's absolutely fantastic. It's ridiculously addictive. When I first saw this, I was like, oh, I'll just click through for 5 minutes. And half an hour later, I was still just clicking through. And I thought it really showed how design can be so powerful. And there wasn't anything new on Spacelog. All the data existed already. But by putting it into this beautifully designed website, it came alive. It really came alive. And the ability to then link to any utterance from an astronaut was kind of cool. Nice tweetable little sound bites, which led me to discover that Michael Collins is by far the coolest of all the Apollo astronauts. He's my hero now. So I love Spacelog. Spacelog is awesome. And something else that isn't directly related to Science Hack Day is after Science Hack Day worked, showed that it did work, and if I could organize it, anybody could organize, because it's really not my bag to be organizing events. But Matt Patterson put together a History Hack Day in the same venue, right? Went to the Guardian, says, we want to do a History Hack Day, taking lots of data to do with history and mashing it up and all that kind of stuff. And there was some wonderful stuff came out of that. And again, with visualizations, this was taking Wikipedia edits of historical events. So they've got timestamps, and they've also got lat-long coordinates, and just visualizing that over time. It's a history of the world in 100 edits, and it's basically just 100 seconds of world history condensed down, right? And it's, again, beautiful, using design to tell that story. And I think there's quite a large opportunity to mash up science and history. And some of my other favorite hacks, I would say, exist in that space of where science and history mash up together. And a site that would be right up there with Spacelog as one of my favorite sites on the internet would be Old Weather. Has anybody seen Old Weather? Okay. So Old Weather is just this wonderful meeting of science and history. And it's made by the same guys who gave us Galaxy Zoo and Moon Zoo and all this stuff, the Zooniverse people. And they've made these wonderful websites that allow people to participate in science. Like, you can literally be a citizen scientist. So with Galaxy Zoo, you're classifying galaxies. This is stuff that's not that hard for human beings, because we look at a picture of a galaxy and we can see, oh, it's got spiral arms, or oh, it's globular. And that's actually very hard for a computer, right? That kind of OCR is really hard. So it's allowing people to contribute to this classification, and not in some kind of mechanical Turk, you know, farmed out way. If you discover something on Galaxy Zoo and somebody writes a paper about it, you are one of the co-authors of that paper. It is true citizen science. Anyway, Galaxy Zoo, awesome, fantastic. All this other stuff they were doing, fantastic. But Old Weather, probably my favorite of all. Because what Old Weather was doing was taking logbooks from the start of the 20th century, from ships at the start of the 20th century. And these logbooks are filled with observation, dates, times, latitudes, longitudes, observations on the weather, right, barometric pressure, all written by human beings in longhand in these logbooks. Very, very hard for a computer to parse. But, you know, we can read it and we can hopefully make out what's being said. So they built the site to allow people to come to the site and essentially transcribe these logbooks. There's, you know, like a slight bit of gamification because you move up in rank on the ship the more you log. So, you know, I'm just a cadet on this ship now, but I could become the lieutenant and then I could become the captain of the ship. But that's not really the reason for doing it. The reason for doing it is, you know, you're helping science. You're putting all this data or getting all this data out of these old logbooks and making it machine readable, which is absolutely wonderful. Old Weathers is right up there for me. And it turns out, so the reason for doing this isn't just that, oh, we need to digitize this stuff and it would be nice to have it on the web. This is climate data. But now it's climate data that stretches back to the start of the 20th century. So scientists doing climate modeling can now have much better models because they have data that stretches further back than their instruments, which is absolutely wonderful. So that is definitely right up there. It's one of my favorite hacks. And so I'll stop geeking out about hacks now.
I don't think that's the end of us geeking out about hacks. Matt, what are your geeky awesome hacks?
All right, so geeking out phase two. So as I mentioned, I'm a particle physicist, and in 2008 I started working on the Babar experiment. This was an experiment that ran at SLAC. Again, it's a national lab on Stanford campus. And over about 10 years, from 99 to about 2008, they collided matter and antimatter, electrons and positrons, and collected a few petabytes of data to analyze. And the end goal was to actually try to understand the difference between matter and antimatter and why the universe that we mostly see is made up of matter and not antimatter. This table is matter. The stars, as far as we can tell, are matter and not antimatter. You may or may not have heard of some of the experiments going on at CERN at the LHC. This is a screenshot of the CMS experiment. I like this phrase from Ariel. These are space-time smashers. These are colliding protons and overlapping their wave functions in space-time, and you're looking for the Higgs boson and signs of supersymmetry. These are all very complicated analyses. The analyses that I did at Babar, even though it's a smaller detector, it's no less challenging. There's numbers that you're parsing through, just streams of recorded information about these particles, the momentum, the energies, where they went, and at the end of the day, you're going to try to make a statement about how nature works. Now, the first level that you start to interact with the data are what I would call an event display. And so what you're seeing here is this 2D representation of this 3D mini fireball, if you want, in the detector and where these particles went. And all these layers of the detector are optimized to measure different things. We don't actually look at pictures like this until we're doing some sort of diagnostic. Usually it's, you know, you look at a billion different collisions and you make some histogram, some plot, and you try to summarize. Again, you usually only use this for diagnostics. But looking at these helps you build up some intuition about what you're trying to understand, not about just the physics, but about the performance of the detector. So when I was a postdoc at Carnegie Mellon, I started mucking around with trying to sonify some of my data, trying to take my data, this multi-dimensional data set, and turn it into sound. And I got some things that kind of half worked, but it was rattling around in my head. And then so when David Harris came to me and said, oh, there's this science hack day that's going to be going on down the street, there might be some people that might want to work with you on this, because I was stuck. You know, I do a lot of coding in C++ and Python and stuff, but I don't know what's the right language to do sonification or even visualization, a lot of this stuff. So he's like, oh, I think there's going to be some people that would like to help you on this, maybe learn about this, and maybe you can get a group together. So we did. So I brought some Babar data, which was text files that I had to explain to them. I said, okay, this is where it's going in the detector in this direction. This is the energy. This is the velocity, if you want that. And over the course of the 24 hours, we hacked together this very, very barely held together with duct tape and code that was able to produce sounds based on the data. And we got it working at like midnight. And people had been hearing us in this room sequestered, like, oh, you guys are serious. Everybody else is doing robots and these cool lights. And we were all trying to understand this stuff. And all of a sudden, we started getting sounds. And there were people that came in. They're like, oh, what is that? And I'm like, well, that's the decay of a B meson. And it's decaying to these things. And they're like, decay of a what? I'm like, oh, well, let me tell you about a B meson now that I've hooked you with these cool sounds and stuff. And there was a moment in the night, actually, where these people that were working with us that were from Yahoo and physicists that weren't particle physicists and designers that were – I'd explain stuff to them, and at some point in the middle of the night, they started talking like particle physicists. And they were like, well, what should we do with particle ID, which is this very, very jargony term in our field? You know, what should a muon sound like? What should a pion sound like? Well, this is cos theta, so if we turn it into X and Y, how do we – And it was amazing because these people were not particle physicists. But if I had any of my collaboration walk in, they would have thought that they were trying to do a real analysis. And it was just fantastic. So again, we had this website that was just held together by bleeding edge code. We wanted something live that people could like map energy onto volume and momentum onto timbre and, you know, energy on some duration of the notes. Make this mapping from these parameters that we were measuring and doing physics analysis to some sort of oral sonic quality. And we had something that just barely worked. But it wasn't completely live, but we were able to demonstrate these sounds. And the fascinating thing was I started as me, because I was trained, I could start to hear differences in these particle decays. So this B meson actually sounds very different than a what's called a light quark jet. And it doesn't matter what that is, but know that I can hear these things. And I started to realize, God, you could start to use this to really develop an intuition for your data that maybe you didn't have before. So because we've got it here, I'm going to play a little 20-second snippet of what a B decay sounds like, at least according to the mapping that I chose. Did anybody hear that? Is that going throughout there?
I don't think so.
Sound?
No? All right. Microphone check. You got it? You want to do that there? So again, the idea was that these things are playing the detector. As they pass through the detector, it's like the wind through a wind chime. They're playing parts of the detector, and you get to choose what they sound like. Some particles move faster than others. Some of them are really slow, and if you stretch out the time into nanoseconds or picoseconds, you get to hear them. Now, what was nice for me is that I could use this now and I could sit down and talk with people about the tools that we were using, kind of bootstrap this idea, and now I could start to develop little visual aids. So in my spare time, I came up with this app. You can download it from my website, and there's a little control panel that allows you to choose what mappings you have. It's written in mostly processing, whether or not it works today as opposed to 6 months ago, I can't guarantee. But this was one of my favorite hacks because it was very personable. And again, it was very inspiring to work with people that were interested in science, and I feel like I kind of infected them with a little bit of knowledge. Now, I participated in the next Science Hack Day, which was just last October, I believe, and I brought
November.
And I brought some data from the LHC, and we did a hack and some visualizations, and it was really cool. People liked working with hot off the presses data from the LHC. But for me, what was very interesting as a scientist and trying to get some feedback also out of this was this person did what they called a beard recognition hack. And they took this little USB microscope, and as you run it over your face, you get this image of whether or not you have little stubble. And I should just make mention that this girl that's using it, that's not a screenshot of what she has. These are mixed up. It's not – I don't know who she is, but I just want to let you know hers was actually registering that it's not Beard Hack. But what was neat was I could look at his code that was posted on GitHub, and I was like, oh, there's actually some really simple Python pattern recognition that just looks at contrast, and so it can identify lines. Now, why that's interesting to me is that when we're teaching students, we use these cloud chambers that use isopropyl alcohol and form a very low, thin layer where it condenses. And if you have radioactive particles that go through, like in the upper right there, you get these tracks where the isopropyl alcohol condenses along the track. But it's just something you watch. And if you let it sit there and you don't put a radioactive element in it, every minute or two, you actually get these muons that are produced by cosmic rays high up in the atmosphere. But it only happens every minute or so. And there's no real way for data logging for this type of little mini experiment. So just by seeing this, I'm like, God, could we use a webcam and then use this very simple software to do contrast recognition for where these tracks are and actually use this to record and maybe do a project where students could build something like this from scratch and then measure cosmic ray flux from the upper atmosphere. So I'm a research scientist right now at Northern Illinois University, and in the fall I'm going to be working, I'm starting a gig as a professor at Siena College in upstate New York. And I've applied for funding to try to get something like this together, put together a website that shows people how to build their own and everything. But the point is that I would not have really thought about this idea unless I'd been going to these hack days. I think it's real interesting the amount of information we have online and blogs and posts, but God, face-to-face interaction is just a whole other level. So again, as a scientist, you know, I'm taking time out of my research to do this, and I think outreach is incredibly important. It's one of the most important things we can do, but it was really this prime example of where there was this feedback from these Hack Day communities. So I think that's where I'm going to end for now and let Ariel and just emphasize that, for scientists, I think these Hack Days that these guys are putting together can be a real game changer in this kind of like exploring these other communities that as scientists we don't always have access to.
Yeah, I just think it's really bragworthy to say that a beard detecting hack inspired cosmic ray detection. It's just unexpected, which is awesome. And it's actually, I guess, a lot of these things are related to sort of my favorite science hacks. My favorite kind of science hacks really tap into invisibility. And this is really because of the idea that 95% of everything is invisible. And when I say 95% of everything is invisible, it's because when you look at all of the matter and all of the energy in the entire universe, 74% is dark energy, 22% is dark matter, less than 5% is all visible matter. If you take out intergalactic gas, which how often do we look at that? Not that often, except in the pretty NASA pictures. The rest, all the stars in the universe, all the planets, everything in this room, everything on this planet makes up less than 0.5% in the universe. So we are very much the et cetera in the universe. And there's all this invisible stuff around us all the time. So dark matter is really some of the coolest invisible stuff, I think. Dark matter is really essentially when you look at galaxies and how they're held together, there's not enough matter that accounts for the amount of gravity that's needed to really hold us all together. So the placeholder name for that is dark matter. All of this sort of weakly interacting particles that that we can't easily detect that are kind of holding us all together, and it's kind of in this globular form that you can see here. So it's really great because we have like this invisible thing that's holding us together. So it's not actually the power of love that's holding us together, but it's the power of dark matter. And so in a lot of ways, this is a very friendly universe. We have this, you know, lovely, adorable friend called dark matter that's, you know, keeping us all together, and that's awesome. But there's also the opposite fact. We have a very evil sort of thing in the universe called dark energy, and dark energy is actually trying to push us all apart. Not necessarily on the atomic level, but we see it more with galaxies that are distant. They're being pushed further and further apart. And so when we look in the universe and we see that we're actually expanding way faster than scientists think we should be expanding. So we call that dark matter. So absolutely 95% of everything is invisible. And so hacks that tap into invisibility to me are really exciting and really weird, like this one. This is a hack called Animal Superpowers. It wasn't created at a Science Hack Day, but it's really cool. Essentially, the idea is that you wear a helmet and a couple of gloves, and you navigate the Earth beneath you, and you can see the Earth as seen from a perspective of an ant. So you kind of get animal superpowers by acting like you're an ant for a day and actually getting this really magnified view of the Earth, which is kind of cool. But these sort of invisibility superpowers can sometimes make you look dorky, like that previous hack. And this one, this is a belt that vibrates every time you face north. If you were at Amber Case's keynote the other day, she mentioned it. And the idea with this is that you begin to understand how to navigate a city more intuitively if you wear this for a few weeks as opposed to visually. So the idea of tapping into invisibility as a superpower is really tapping into the idea of sense affordances. And I think this sort of touches on a little bit of the particle wind chime as well. Different senses have different affordances. And so sometimes our ears can hear something better than our eyes can see them. Different senses can kind of make things visible that were otherwise invisible to us. And some people actually experience this naturally through synesthesia. And synesthesia is essentially where you have different senses that are crossed, that are crossing their wires. So some people with synesthesia report actually associating letters with different colors. Some people have reported that when they hear a really loud sound, they see a ripple across their vision and other cool things like that. So tapping into synesthesia is sort of this superpower that some of us have, but not all of us have. A group of hackers at Science Hack Day created a really creepy hack called Synesthesia. I'll just let you all react to that for a moment. So Synesthesia is a hack that came out of Science Hack Day in November, and the idea was that they wanted to simulate what it was like to be synesthetic. And so they created this mask, which I'll walk through. It's this really, really creepy mask, but it's really awesome. Essentially what they did is they took a bunch of vibrating speakers and they attached it to someone's head. And because, I think 12 different vibrating speakers, and because it was a hack day, they only had 24 hours to make a mask. So the only mask pattern that they could find in 24 hours was an open mask pattern for a GIMP mask. So they created this GIMP mask. They sewed it themselves. You know, they came here with practically nothing. And they sewed this GIMP mask up with all the vibrating speakers. They wired it all up to an Arduino, where the mouse should be, as you can see, and a webcam. And with the idea being that so any information that comes through the webcam, different parts of your face start vibrating. So you can actually start feeling sight and feeling where parts of the room are darker and parts of the room are lighter. And so you get to wear this really creepy mask and navigate around and try and feel where different parts of the room are. It was just a lot of fun, and it's really cool to be able to tap into your different senses that way. Similarly, there's also a few hacks that tap into different things, maybe a little less creepy. Someone wanted to create a font that was based on wind drag. So they created a makeshift wind tunnel, and they recorded the wind drag of each of these letters. And so they wanted to make a font that was that all the letters had equal wind drag in them. So I don't know why this would be useful necessarily, but if you want a typeface that has equal wind drag, this is what it looks like. And so they actually, you know, went through and recorded all these, and so this is what a typeface with equal wind drag looks like, something you don't normally see visible to you, but now it is. So, you know, make use of it somehow. There's also this hack, which was more, I guess, bio-based. This was what you're actually seeing here is the extraction of strawberry DNA. But they're extracting strawberry DNA using all edible materials. So they wanted to create a DNA acary, so to speak, using all drinkable edible materials so that you could actually have a cocktail that where you were drinking extracted DNA. Just for note, it was absolutely disgusting. It was really, really gross, and lots of alcohol, as you can expect. So what you're actually seeing in this picture is these, I think, polymers that are really long. So when you extract DNA, even though it's really tiny, the strings essentially are so long that they all start globbing up together, so you can kind of visibly see it. And there's been another panel at this at South By that, unfortunately, I think it was right before ours, but it was talking about weather balloon payloads. And so, of course, weather balloon payloads are becoming a lot more ubiquitous, and they're just really exciting because you get to see Earth from a site that you normally don't see. Either you get to see the curvature of the Earth if you're going 30 kilometers up. And in this project, they were actually mapping the ground of the Earth. So they tried to do a grassroots aerial mapping project using these weather balloons and just a simple camera. So if you're kind of thinking about all these things and thinking like, wow, how could I make a synesthesia mask where I can walk around in Austin all the time and freak people out? Or if you would just rather hack on your own science ideas, that might be less creepy. Where can you start? Jeremy, do you have any recommendations on what people can do today that could help them get started science hacking?
Well, yeah, I'll come at it from sort of the web side of things rather than the physical hardware side. And if you do any mashups and web development, you're probably familiar with all these already. But I think scientists certainly can benefit from knowing about these tools that are out there available and free. So I was talking about data visualization earlier and how important and how useful a tool that can be. There's the Google Chart API. It started off fairly rudimentary, and now there's quite a lot you can do with it. It's nice. There's some articles been written about, there's documentation on the Google site, but there's articles been written about how to use it from people like Brian Suda, who wrote a whole book about designing with data. And I find it to be quite useful, especially if you've got 24 hours to hack something together and you need to have graphs and charts and things. It's pretty nice. Another useful tool for developers is something from Yahoo called YQL. Now, it is from Yahoo, so it could be switched off tomorrow for all we know, but it's like a meta API. This is like, it's like an API for APIs. So there's lots of websites out there have APIs, but then you've kind of got to learn the API of each website. So you've got to learn the Flickr API, now you've got to learn the Amazon API, now you've got to learn the Guardian API, whatever. And this tries to even the playing field by allowing you to use one syntax to mash up data from all these different APIs. The syntax it uses is essentially SQL. So if you're familiar with querying databases, it's like that, except now instead of querying databases, you're querying the web. So you select from Flickr where tag equals trending topic on Twitter, right? So mashing stuff up together. It's just quite useful because at Science Hack Day London, we had some lightning talks at the start, partly from scientists and partly from web people. And Christian Heilmann, who was working at Yahoo at the time, gave a talk about YQL, just demoed it, showed what you could do with it. And there was a whole bunch of different scientists in the room who were like, wow, we had no idea this existed. And all these plans for projects that we thought would take months, we could maybe do really quickly using these tools. So I find that quite useful. And then finally, just one that I think in general is so useful to any kind of mashup and development is the fact that we have GitHub now. So it can seem overwhelming. Sometimes you have an idea, but you can't finish it or you can't bring it to fruition. You throw it up there on GitHub and allow other people to take it and fork it and run with it and feed stuff back to you. GitHub's been great for collaboration in general, and can also be really good for finishing those hacks that you started a hack day but never quite get around to finishing. So those are just a few that I find pretty useful.
And Matt, what are your recommendations for what people should be doing today from your perspective?
What people could be doing. I think that there is a tremendous benefit from coming to places like South by Southwest, the Science Hack Days, seeing what people are doing, getting really inspired, going and reading, following the science podcasts and stuff. But from interacting with everybody, I think there's another level that can be gone, and I think that there's nothing wrong with getting your hands dusty. Ariel came up with this line, and I think it's right. I think we all have the capability of learning a lot more than we think we can, or maybe a lot more than we know now. And I think that we can all have that capability, actually get some of our old textbooks if we want, our old physics books, statistics especially, and go through them and try to really learn what these things are. Like, I think the people that I worked with at the Science Hack Days, like at this most recent one in San Francisco with the LHC data, we started actually going through the equations that Newton told us relates energy, momentum, and mass, and then we went to the equations that Einstein taught us relate energy, momentum, and mass. And people are perfectly capable of learning these things, and I think when you really learn it and when you grok it and you sit down for an hour a week even, it changes how you view the world. It's changed how I see even just casual talks. And I think that there's so much available on the web with Khan Academy. You know, MIT is putting lectures online from its introductory physics and statistics courses. Stanford has got a YouTube channel with lectures from its physics and statistics courses. I mean, it changes how you view the world when you really sit down and go through it. And it sounds kind of stodgy and boring, but it's not when you go out into the world or you go to a conference like this and you look at things differently. Like early this morning, they had an asteroid panel. And Plate, bad astronomer, is like talking about, if you had all the planets aligned, you know, it would be only 1/50th the gravitational pull of the moon. I'm thinking, wait, is that right? You know? And I'm like thinking, God, this is a perfect problem I could give my students. It's very simple. It's only got a couple of equations. You can look up the information on Wikipedia. And when you do something like that, you have this tremendous self of satisfaction. Like, God, I'm starting to really understand the universe. And I think that these events are great inspiration, but I think there is something we can go and take it to the next level. And again, not just physics, but like statistics. I think when you understand statistics, which is so important in my analysis, it kind of changes how you view the culture and the way the media relates stuff to you. So again, it sounds kind of boring, but with the amounts of stuff online that you can learn from, I think we're at a different level. It's much easier and much, much maybe less boring to learn this stuff.
Thanks. So my recommendations for people are really to go to Hack Days or organize Hack Days because they are pure joy, like this guy with the Navis tag, which is awesome. Poor Navis tags don't work anymore that much, but I loved them. Hack Days are really awesome, and so for me, it's really about being a spark for future collaborations or future ideas or future things to come out of, and they're really, really just meant to have fun and have really unexpected things come out of them. Still, like having cosmic ray detection come out of a beer detector hack is the weirdest thing I've heard, possibly weirder than the synesthesia mask, it's all about kind of this unexpected sort of stuff. And I think, you know, nowadays I hear a lot of people talking about hackathons and codathons as these things where you're going to create this like well-polished solution for your city or other things like that. And while that's great, to me, Hack Days aren't really about creating products. It's not about, you know, not about that. If you want to make a hack that detects when you need to shave, like, go for it. You know, it shouldn't have to end up being a product. It should just be something awesome that you're really excited about. And you don't know where it's going, and that doesn't matter. And that's what Hack Days are really for. So if you haven't been to a Hack Day, I really encourage you to do so. Specifically with Science Hack Day, it's now become a global thing, thankfully. Thanks to some help from the Sloan Foundation, Science Hack Day is actually happening all over the world. The next one, I think, is in Nairobi in April. Then in May, there's one in Chicago. It's going to be one in Iceland in June, I think. They're happening all over. But if they're not happening in your town, we've actually open sourced the instructions for how to create a Science Hack Day in your city. So if you go to sciencehackday.com, you can actually figure out how to make one happen in your city, which I definitely encourage. Mostly it's just about getting excited. And even if you don't go to a Science Hack Day, you know, do this, you know, on your own weekend and just get excited and you know, make stuff with friends. And it's just really awesome. And you don't need to be a developer. You don't need to be a scientist. You can be anyone and just make stuff. All you have to have really is just this amazing passion for, oh my God, that's so creepy and awesome and cool, like I have with so many things. So that's really about it. Let's see. We have maybe about 15 minutes or so for questions. So if you guys want to start thinking about questions and coming up to the mic, feel free to start doing so now. We're happy to take questions. Do keep them short and sweet. We don't necessarily need to know your life story because we will be here afterwards, and we're happy to talk to you about that. So if you have any, if you have any problems or emotional, you know, uncertainties, we can talk to you about that after the panel. we'll be here all day, folks. But in the meantime, if you have short and sweet questions, please feel free to come up to the mic, and we're happy to help.
That was awesome. Thank you, guys. I'm just curious to hear, just from the experiences you've had, if any of you have maybe some quick stories or examples of where you've seen youth getting involved, youth being impacted. Just thinking about my own kids and middle school age kids and even younger, but just getting kids involved with seeing science in a new way. Just curious from your experiences if you might have some insight on that to share, or some ideas for things to consider with getting younger kids kind of excited about some of this stuff you're talking about.
Well, I do have something. This is not so much a sort of a bottom-up hack, but it's more of a top-down project. But one of the other sort of lightning talks at the start of the Science Hack Day in London was from some people who are working with the Wellcome Trust. Wellcome Trust is kind of like, a UK equivalent of the Sloan Foundation, a non-profit dedicated to furthering science and understanding. And they're working on this project that's kind of in parallel with the Olympics, to get young kids to kind of understand the science of exercise and sport and all this stuff. So, again, talking about data and physical objects, this is kind of going the other way. This is about taking data from sensors and getting it onto the web. And I'm not sure at what stage this project is right now, but the idea was they would have sensors for kids. Now, it used to be that getting sensors, you know, on a human body to measure things like heart rate and you know, metabolism and all this stuff, it was expensive and it was bulky. But, you know, thanks to Moore's Law and all sorts of things, they're getting really, really small and really, really cheap. So they were demoing this thing that was like a bouncing rubber ball. It was really durable and you could bounce around. Kids could run around with that. And then hopefully, you know, see what to do with that data. And they were looking for ideas. What should we do with this data? If we're going to collect all this wonderful data with these sensors, what can we do with it? And there are some issues around privacy, obviously, because we're dealing with children here. But it was a really interesting project. I'll see if I can find a URL to it and point it your way. That's the one I can think of off the top of my head about involving kids with science.
Yeah, at Science Hack Day San Francisco, we had a bunch of kids show up. So far, kids are welcome to come, but mostly it's adults who come, just because a lot of my work focuses on getting people who are otherwise forgotten about or forgotten to the science industry, which happens to be like adults who chose different careers. But a bunch of kids ended up coming, and they created a video game. And over the course of the weekend, someone was actually working on some video game code, and he worked with them over the weekend. And by the end of the weekend, they had coded like this Pikachu video game, which was really awesome. So with them, the experience seemed to be, less about like, look at this weird, crazy stuff, and like, wow, look what I was able to create. I was able to create this Pikachu video game over the weekend and learn code, which was really valuable for them.
The one other thing I'll mention, I'm not sure if you've heard about it, is the Google Science Fair project. So if you go to Google and Google Science Fair, last year they did this and they had kids from all over the country compete, and you've got these web forms that they fill out where they have to have a hypothesis and their procedure in the end, and then winners got brought out to the Google campus and they picked the winners there. And it was really neat because it helps them, like the kids kind of codify their questions and their problems in a real scientific method kind of way. So I think that's a real positive thing that they're doing and can spread all over the country, you know.
Just one last thing I want to say on the subject of kids and hack around with science. I find it really interesting. A lot of stuff that we see as being really cool, this website, you know, this thing on a screen taking this data. Kids are like, well, whatever, screens, you know. Physical things, like, they're blown away by, like, oh my God, this printed out pieces of paper that is, you know, got data from the web is awesome. So I find really, it's like, you know, paper, hardware, physical things, they seem to respond to really, you know, more than we do.
Actually, mine's a follow-up on that. My name is Steve Amos. I'm doing a lot of work right now with kids in that regard. And you're right, how do we connect that aspect of kids as citizen scientists, so to speak, in hack? And I'm wondering, I mean, even in this room, there's incredible talent, incredible knowledge. Is there, within the site that you mentioned, a way that people can, like, share so that we may reach out and say, hey, we're trying to do some work. It could be in Detroit, or it could be in London, or it could be in Nairobi, wherever it is, and be able to connect so that maybe there's some talent that says, hey, here's some ideas we'd have that we'd like to help connect with those teachers or those kids in those local areas. And if there's anybody besides the panel that would have a thought on that, just please let me know. My hashtag is GRS team, GRSTEAM. So.
Awesome. So we actually, if you go to sciencehackday.com, there is actually a link to a wiki, and on that wiki are all the cities that are planning on doing Science Hack Days that haven't yet, and they list their contact information. And they are all looking for help, I would say, from everyone. It really is like a team effort, because it's not enough to just get one community involved in this. When we're planning, we're often trying to get like all different types of people from all different types of backgrounds to come. And so all these cities, you know, each city is responsible for organizing their own. And so if you go on there, there's, I think, oh gosh, maybe 25 different cities listed right now who are all planning on the wiki. And so reaching out to them would be great.
Another project that I learned about actually through another event that Ariel had planned, this Friends of the Future, is if you go to Scientific American, they were organizing this 1,000 scientists in 1,000 days. And I think, if you just poke around, Google it, probably you'll find it. But they were trying to pair up scientists with schools and school districts where you would either have a scientist come and talk about their work or connect through a Skype or Google Hangout connection. And I kind of get the impression that they almost have too many more scientists because I signed up for it about a year ago and I never got called to interact with anyone. So they might be looking for school district. But I think that that's a real positive program, not just, you know, even if you can't physically get someone there, the students can interact and ask questions. So, yeah, 1,000 scientists in 1,000 days, I believe, is what it's called.
I just want to say that, you know, it's, the Internet's great and is able to connect people at geographical distances, which is wonderful. But there's really nothing quite like people getting together in the same room, you know, in the same place. And one of the nice things about Science Hack Days or any of these kind of events that gets people together in the same room is they realize, oh, I'm not alone, right? That kind of inspiration you get from going to a conference or some other kind of event where you realize, oh, my people, I'm not toiling alone. And this isn't directly related to Science Hack Day. This could be anything. If you're a web developer working on something, you'd feel like you're isolated, but getting together with other web developers in your town is wonderful. There were some friends of mine put together a site called Django People, which was just you could sign up and say, I do Django programming. I live here. These are some sites I built. And as a result of that, there ended up being like a Django meetup in San Diego because all these people who didn't realize they lived so close together, were all doing Django, were able to get together in real life. So there really is something for getting people in the same room. So one of the nice things about Science Hack Days is if you can get this mixture of web developers, teachers, scientists, you know, the more the merrier, in the same physical space, a lot more seems to get done than you get with emails, wikis, and stuff like that.
Okay, there seems to be a clear affinity between the kind of stuff you're talking about with the Science Hack Days and the whole DIY maker kind of movement. Is there any, and there's been a lot, they've had a lot of success in reaching out to children in doing the sort of grassroots kind of thing and the community sort of thing. I know that there was Makers Faire in Brighton last year. I went to the World Makers Faire in New York. There's a lot of energy around that. Has there been any thought of kind of maybe trying to piggyback on that, sort of, you know, running your event, you know, running a Science Hack Day event in close conjunction with something like a Makers event so that you could kind of get a mashup of those two movements to see if maybe that's get even more energy behind what you're doing.
I mean, they show up anyway.
Yeah.
Believe me. Which is great. There was a certain amount of hardware hacking at the London one. There was a lot more, I think, in the Palo Alto Hack Day, and I think maybe more again at the second one.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say that running Science Hack Day adjacent to events, yeah, it can be great, and I think some cities are considering that. I know that it's not Maker Faire, but in Iceland, there's PopTech is going to happen there, and they're going to see if they can run Science Hack Day adjacent to that. Mm-hmm. It is something where there's a lot of affinity. There is a slight difference, though, in that Maker Faire is often about showing stuff that you've already created, and Science Hack Day is all about what can you make in 24 hours. And they're very similar.
And I think that may be the kind of differentiation you need between Science Hack Day and Maker's Day. Here's the cool stuff that'll inspire you. Now here's a chance for you to make something yourself.
Right, or even vice versa, like have a Science Hack Day and you know, have the best hacks and present at a Maker Faire. So those things are being considered. But yeah, I think it's kind of all fair game. I think as long as you're not asking people to focus on too many different types of things, as far as like, you know, a bar camp and a hack day, many people try and mash those up and that ends up not being super well because you're asking people too many things. Yeah. But yeah, having things adjacent to events definitely helps as far as just getting different communities to attend the event.
And actually, I'm thinking about in September in Brighton, there's a whole bunch of sort of web-related and art-related events going on. So we turned September into this like Brighton Digital Festival. And I'm definitely looking at like trying to find a weekend there where I could fit in a Science Hack Day, do a Science Hack Day Brighton. And there will be a Maker Faire towards the start of the month. So absolutely sort of glomming these events together can be good. You know, a rising tide raises all boats.
Hi. I've gone to some of these hackathon events more in like a coding space, and I found that it's really hard to make something that actually works in that constrained amount of time. And I'm wondering if there's any kind of concerted effort to like pick up someone else's project and, you know, carry it forward and try to finish it. Does that happen in these events?
Well, somebody did actually just launch a site recently to have an event. I forget, it was something like finish it. Like literally a weekend of hackers where you're not allowed to start any new hacks. You just have to finish the hacks you started at other ones. But it's an absolutely fair point because people can be very ambitious in what they're trying to do. And, you know, you don't pull it off in 24 hours. And that's kind of something you learn as you go along. It's like, oh, actually, if I just kept it focused, I probably could have finished it. But again, I would say things like GitHub can be great when it's if it's software, where you can just throw it up there and say, please, somebody take this, finish it.
Yeah, and I can give you some of my own experience. You know, the wind chime, like I said, we just barely had sound going. And I'm like, God, I'd really like to see visual cues with the sound. And so it was about, you know, 6-9 months of me just working in my spare time, you know, because I got all this other work and that I've got to get done. And so this was really hard to. And I got something together that you can download. And then at this last hack day, I was like, oh, we got something done. I'm going to be really ambitious. We're going to take LHC data, and I'm going to teach everybody how to analyze it in the space of a few hours, and then they're going to hack something together, and I'm going to post this stuff on GitHub beforehand. And like at 10 o'clock at night, I mean, Ariel knows, I came and I was talking to him. I'm like, I'm so depressed. We didn't do anything. I failed. I failed everybody. And then I got this inspiration, and like I had this like 3-hour burst of creativity, and we got something going, you know, and we got something hacked together, and you can actually see these things and accumulating data. But for me, it was actually really important to realize we got something together. I actually shouldn't take this any further. Like, it was the act of building something, seeing how far we could get, and then that was really as much as we could do, was as important as the previous hack day where I got something that I was able to carry forward. And I think sometimes it's actually good to learn what to let go, that it was a learning experience, that it was on its own. Because I do think, I mean, we talked about this a lot, in 24 hours there's a limited amount you can do. So those are my two experiences at both of those ends, something that was worth carrying forward and then something that was like, okay, we got something, I'm going to put it aside for now and let it be.
So we've got just about 4 minutes left, so we're going to try and take these last two questions really quickly.
Okay. Hi. Thank you. Beautiful panel. I love the idea that there are no special people. You don't need to, you can be whatever you want if you like what you must do. As Ariel, that don't have background in science, but is working at NASA, that's fantastic. And my question is how to begin in science. What's the initial point for people with no science background to create something scientific advanced as hack days people do?
Yeah, well, I mean, we've discussed some of the things that we would recommend. Like if you are on the coding side, GitHub is great. And just reading up on science in general. With me, like my relation is really just watching science documentaries on the weekend because I don't really have a life, and that's what I do. You know, surprisingly, I learned quite a bit from those, and it's great. But as far as like going to hack days and organizing one, you really, you know, all you have to do is be an organized person. If you've got that, then you've got everything going for you. I think it's really just saying, hey, I you know, kind of raising your hand and saying, I'm really excited about this stuff. Is anyone else? And seeing what goes from there. It's a long trip to, you know, actually doing different things, but you surprisingly just meeting people actually goes a long way.
And I think your spacehack.org is a nice portal actually to ways that citizen scientists, I mean, if you want to say.
Yeah, spacehack.org is just a directory of ways to participate in space exploration. So it's space specific, but it catalogs all these different ways in which anyone with or without a science background can participate.
Yeah, just to say that, I mean, it sounds like a flippant answer to say that watching science documentaries is how you get into science, but actually, I think it's really important to value the storytellers who can get people excited about science. You know, historically, people like Carl Sagan or Richard Feynman, you know, James Burke, now we've got Brian Cox, these people who do make it accessible and make it exciting. More of those kind of people, it's wonderful.
Hi. So as a designer who's into scientists, things, and but it's always been intimidated about going to any sort of hackathon or anything like that. Ariel, have you found any way of convincing other designers to go with you? Or Jeremy mentioned it's always trouble getting designers there.
Yeah. It can be intimidating, and I'm really, at least with Science Hack Day, I'm really, really trying to fight that. With San Francisco, we had, I think, 33% developers, 20% scientists, 20% designers, and the rest were a mixed bag of anything from a lawyer to a roboticist. But it is intimidating, and I really hate that, and I really hate the people who make it seem like if you're not a developer, if you don't know how to code, then, you know, you're behind, too bad, you need to go back to school. I think, yeah, the best thing you can do is you know, talk to, I guess, go to a hackathon, maybe go with some friends and prove people wrong. You know, maybe a lot of times, actually, it's the fact that hackathons would like to have designers show up, but they're not doing a great job of reaching out to them. So also just talking to organizers and asking if there's any place for designers. They might actually say, yeah, we're actually looking for them. We don't know any. You know, there's a really big problem with outreach in that regard. But, yeah, I really hate anyone who makes it feel intimidating to join science, to join being a coder. It's crap, because you can absolutely create anything you want. And you don't need to have specific skills to do so. So on that note, I will thank you all for coming and getting excited with us.